I take you now back to a simpler account of the death of Jesus. This is from Mark's Gospel, chapter 15, verses 34 to 39, and it reads, "At the ninth hour, the day was divided by the Jews into four periods of 3 hours. Put very simply, it was sunrise to sunset was divided into four watches, and midday's obviously in the middle, and mid-morning is another cut-off point, and mid-afternoon's another. They didn't have watches. So the first hour is from first light to the middle of the morning, early morning. The sixth hour is late morning, getting towards sun at its height. The ninth hour, in their terminology, was early afternoon. And the 12th hour is that period of time between the middle of the afternoon and sunset. Is that okay? So that's the, so when he says at the ninth hour, he means sometime in the hottest part of the day towards the middle of the afternoon. Jesus cried out in a loud voice. And now we have Aramaic words, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. And Mark translates them into Greek, and now we have the English, my God, why have you deserted me? When some of those who stood by heard this, says Mark, they said, listen, he's calling on Elijah. Then he goes on to tell how they ran around and got some vinegar and put it in a sponge and held it up to his lips and were waiting for maybe Elijah would come. Because they had this expectation that at the end Elijah would come and issue in the last kind of judgment of God. But that wasn't to be. Jesus gave a loud cry and gave forth his breath, his spirit. And Mark makes two very simple comments. One, the veil of the temple was torn from top to bottom. And two, the centurion who was standing in front of him had seen the manner of his dying, how he had died. And he said, in truth, this man was a son of God. Well, that's the scene. It's stark. It appears simple. But in that really beautiful painting or portrait that Mark leaves us with as the last portrait of Jesus' life, we've got an amazing amount of insight and prayer and recognition of what was really happening. Let me start with you looking at the last cry of Jesus. What was it that he said at the end? Whatever it was there made them look for Elijah and so on. Can we reconstruct maybe the last words of Jesus? Be interesting if we could. And I think we can, so let's try. I suggest to you that the last words of Jesus, the loud cry that he issued from the cross, it could only be about one word because he died of respiratory arrest, asphyxiation, he didn't have any breath. So it's not going to be a long sentence. I wonder if it's fair to imagine that his word that he cried was Eliyahu. Eliyahu. Eliyahu is the Hebrew for Elijah. El is God, E is my God, Yahu, Yahweh. My God, Yahweh. Yahweh, the Redeemer, God is my God. No wonder if he said Eliyahu that the bystanders raced around thinking Elijah was coming. But another interesting, obviously they were wrong, and the Gospel puts another interpretation on it. It is also an interesting point, it may or may not be related, that in the Ugaritic dialect, we now know this through archaeological discoveries, which was a Canaanite dialect. You see, we're not exactly sure what language Jesus spoke. He would have spoken Greek, probably. He may have spoken Latin, unlikely. He seems to have spoken Aramaic. But it might be like if you're in Italy today, you may speak Italian, but you may also have your own village dialect, which is quite different from the normal Italian, or in many countries this would be the case, wouldn't it? You might be in Ireland and you might speak English, but you might also be in the west of Ireland and handle Gaelic very well from where you were born. So it's not unthinkable that Jesus' mother tongue may have been Ugarit, or one of those Canaanite dialects that he learnt from mum and dad as a little baby, and then he got into the wider community where they spoke Aramaic and Greek and so on. I don't know that. It's not unlikely. It is interesting that the word Yahu in Ugarit means my. So Eliyahu, if he went right back to his own mother's tongue, could have been simply my God. In fact, that's what the New Testament takes up. Because what Mark has done in our gospel text is taken the my God and made it the first words of Psalm 22. My God, why have you deserted me? Or in Aramaic, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Or in Matthew's Gospel, which is in Hebrew, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. What they've done is, they've taken, perhaps, I suggest, the words my God, and they've said, like, if I said my God, well, what am I saying? What are you saying if you say? What's it mean? How did he say it? You can say my God, how? In despair, in ecstasy, in wonder, in a sense of loss, in a sense of recognition. There's a million ways of saying my God. How did Jesus cry? What was in his eyes? What was in the tone of his voice? What was his prayer? What was the impression of that last cry on John and the mother there? What did those who heard it, you know what I'm asking you, don't you? What did they go away with? And what they went away with was an impression, of course. An experience, a very deep and moving one. It is a fact that when Mark and his community, and Matthew exactly the same, they are saying to us in that gospel text, the best way to find out what Jesus said is to go back and read Psalm 22. And now that's our poetry, it's all in our anthologies of poetry, eh? Go back and read the psalm and you'll know what he was saying. Let me read it for you. And as I read it, and this is exactly what Mark wants you to do in the Gospel, you could get an impression of the prayer of Jesus on the cross as the early church understood it. It reads like this. So imagine Jesus on the cross. Close your eyes if you want to. See him there and hear his cry, and I'll meditate with you on this psalm. My God, why have you deserted me? How far from saving me the words I groan. I call all day, my God, but you never answer. All night long I call, and I cannot rest. Jesus is at the very edge of suffering. He can't think. He can't pray. He feels totally deserted and abandoned. His soul, if you like, is in a depression, faced with the excruciating pain and the meaninglessness of this terrible outrage against everyone he loves and himself. And he does feel abandoned by God. But he trusts. So he remembers He remembers what supports his trust, and the psalm goes on. Yet, Holy One, you who make your home in the praises of Israel, in you our fathers put their trust. They trusted and you rescued them. They called to you for help and they were saved. They never trusted you in vain. Yet here am I, now more worm than man, scorn of mankind, jest of the people. All who see me jeer at me. They toss their heads and sneer. He relied on Yahweh. Let Yahweh save him. If Yahweh is his friend, let him rescue him. And Jesus sees his mother and remembers a bit more. Yet you drew me out of the womb. You entrusted me to my mother's breast. Placed on your lap from my birth. That's the Father's lap. Placed there and named by the Father. Placed on your lap, Abba, from my birth. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not stand aside. Trouble is near. I have no one to help me. I'm like water draining away. My bones are all disjointed. My heart is like wax melting inside me. My palate is drier than a potsherd, and my tongue is stuck to my jaw. A gang of villains closes me in. They tie me hand and foot and leave me lying in the dust of death. I can count every one of my bones, and there they glare at me, gloating. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothes. Do not stand aside, Yahweh. O, my strength, come quickly to my help. Then I shall proclaim your name to my brothers. I shall praise you in full assembly. And then the psalm concludes. You who fear Yahweh, praise him. Israel, glorify him. Jacob, revere him. For he has not despised or disdained the poor man in his poverty. He has not hidden his face from him, but has answered him when he called. Psalm 22 is a glorious psalm. It's about someone at the very depth of suffering who places trust in Yahweh, and the trust is answered. I'm confident that what Mark and Matthew and their communities are asking us to do with that cry of Jesus is to see it for what it is. It is a cry on the edge of despair. I mean, that's the wrong word, but it's the cry at the very outer edge of suffering. It's a real cry from the depths of abandonment. But it's a cry that rises up into ecstasy, and what the centurion saw when he saw it, what they heard when they heard it, was a cry of recognition. That from that trust, Jesus made his trust. Jesus believed in the God that he knew, his Abba, and in that very act, God revealed his face to Jesus. And he was taken into God's embrace and into the mystery of what we call the afterlife. And it showed in his eyes, it showed in his voice, and that my God was ultimately an ecstatic recognition of the face of God, who answered Jesus, the poor man, when he called. He didn't see God and therefore trust. He remembered, he knew. He put his trust in God when it was dark, and having placed his trust there, God was able then to take him. Luke, you may recall, has another word for Jesus' last words, the words, "Into your hand I commit my spirit," and it's interesting to read that psalm too, which takes a different poetic inspiration than either Matthew or Mark, but comes to the same point. The last words of this psalm are the words, "El, El Emet," faithful God. I've heard it, seen it written, but not been able to trace it with any certainty. But it has been suggested this was the prayer of a devout Jew on going to bed at night. It certainly is the prayer that the church has taken up to end the night prayer of the office. I'll read it to you, and it's the same mood as Psalm 22. "In you, Yahweh, I take shelter. Never let me be disgraced. In your righteousness, deliver me, rescue me. Turn your ear to me, make haste. Be a sheltering rock for me, a walled fortress to save me. For you are my rock, my fortress. For the sake of your name, guide me and lead me. Pull me out of the net that they've spread for me, for you are my refuge. Into your hands I commit my spirit." And look at the end. "You have redeemed me, faithful God." Jesus was redeemed by God, redeemed from death, redeemed from the brokenness of his humanity, and taken into the transparent glory and mystery of God. And so the church looking on, and here I conclude this, the two comments made by Mark now become very obvious, though I missed them for years and you might miss them too. The veil of the temple was torn from top to bottom. What's the veil of the temple? The veil of the temple is an architectural symbol. It was the veil that covered the Holy of Holies. No one was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies to see the face of God, and that was their expression of it. Because God is the mystery that you cannot see. No one can see God and live. The high priest once a year was allowed to go in with his eyes veiled and offer incense to God and prayer on the feast of Yom Kippur, and then come out, and all his vestments had to be burnt, and he had to go through a whole week of washings and things because of the daring to go into the mystery of God. And what happened on the cross, says Mark, or Matthew also, means that when Jesus died, the veil was torn asunder. It can't be fixed again. It's gone. Nothing can now separate us from the God. We now move into the sanctuary, says the letter to the Hebrews. We can all look at the face of God and live, because when you look at Jesus on the cross, you are looking at the face of God. That is the face of God now unveiled. Do you see the point of it? And secondly, says Mark, writing in Rome, beautiful Catholic doctrine, this one. Who saw all this? Mary, the mother of God, may well have seen it. The beloved disciple may well have seen it. But what would that have done to me? Because I'm neither Mary nor the beloved disciple. Anybody can be a bloody centurion. Isn't that the point? The centurion who had no faith background, I mean, no catechetical things. He wasn't brought up by the Marsh brothers or anybody. He had no special kind of training. He wasn't a Jew. He didn't belong. He was just a bloke, and he murdered people day in and day out because it was his job, and he was bored. And all he wanted to get back and have a tooies in the middle of the afternoon. And he'd done it again and again and again. A bloke like that, notice how beautifully it's written by Mark, who was standing in front of Jesus. And what happened? It doesn't say he saw that he died. Sometimes we can be taught carelessly in our catechisms that we're redeemed because Jesus died. No, we're not. We're redeemed because of how he died. There's a big difference. That Jesus died is a murder. How he died is a love-giving, free, powerful, and very beautiful thing that we can all admire. There's nothing beautiful about Martin King's death except the way he died. And that might stir us. the manner of Jesus dying, the freedom, the love, the prayer, the faith, the crying out from the depths, and he was in the depths, just like everybody around him dying, but the cry, all of that is redemptive, liberating and saving and giving hope and direction and meaning to us. And Mark is saying, anybody can see it. Just look. Just really look at it. And nobody cannot be moved by this to see what God is and to see what man is. It's all we preach. Paul said, all I preach is Christ crucified.